Song. And welcome to our introduction to Parsha number 13 of Torah, Shemot. Our studies for Shemot begin in Exodus 1, verse 1 through chapter 6, verse 1. The half Torah readings come from Isaiah 26, verse 6 through chapter 28, 13, and Jeremiah, verse 1, verse chapter 2, verse 3. And the Brit Hadashah readings come from Acts 7, verse 30 through chapter 8, verse 4. A new Sefer Torah beckons to us. A great cloud of witnesses reaches out across the ages to welcome us with open arms to the great adventure sequences of the second book of the Pentateuch. The ancient Hebrew scroll that's about to unveil mysteries hidden from the foundation of the universe contains some of the most famous narratives of any piece of literature. This book contains the play-by-play accounts of the Creator taking on the role of divine bridegroom and delighting in and engaging in rituals of courtship with and exchanging his vows with a chosen bride. The ultimate love story. Our Creator wants it to be our story as well. The Hebrew text of the second book of Torah begins with a vav, prefix. In the English, one reads this as and. This conjunction at the forefront of the narrative seems strange to English readers. After all, English readers are taught from childhood that they are to begin a sentence with a conjunction or disjunctive, and or a but is the epitome of poor grammar. The Hebrew mindset is vastly different. In the Hebraic worldview, absolutely everything that happens is connected to that which has gone before, and for that matter, to everything that will follow. In the eyes of a Hebrew, one cannot understand any book or revelation without having experienced and become firmly rooted in that which became before. To a Hebrew, all books are mere sequels to Genesis. And to a Hebrew, all revelations brought to light after the death of Yosef are simply outworkings of the essential veins of eternal truth and wisdom that the Holy One generously exposed in the Book of Beginnings. The testimony of the Vav prefix with which the second book of Torah begins is that Sefer Torah that preceded it constitutes the eternal spring out of which all of its streams of revelation flow. The scandalous testimony of the Vav prefix is that the Sinaitic covenant cannot truly be understood by anyone who does not understand the prophetic patterns laid out in the narrative of Creation Week, and who knows not the blessing and sweet rest of the seventh day, and has forgotten the geography and events of Eden, or know intimately the scent of the garment of skin crafted by the Holy One for Adam and Hava. The Vav prefix at the beginning of this book testifies to all with ears to Shema that the ten plagues cannot be understood without reference to what broke Avram and Sarai free from the house of Pharaoh generations before. It further testifies that the significance of the Passover lamb can't be truly grasped by anyone who does not remember the conversations between Avraham and Yitzhak as they made the way up Mount Moriah. The letter Vav, with its hint of bad grammar in the English-speaking world, seeks to make it clear that the revelation of the tabernacle and its furnishings and its service and its priesthood can't be fully appreciated by anyone who has not recently relived the tossing of the Ark of Noah and shared with Avram and Sarai the sweet pleasure of entertaining divine visitors in a tent, and seen a ram with its horns caught in a thicket descend from heaven on atop of a mountain. You may remember that as Sefer Bereshit drew to a close, Yosef's bones were laying disgracefully, unburied in a box above the flood-prone soil of Egypt. Yaakov had died back in exile's 17th year. Yosef continued to serve as Pharaoh's viceroy for another 64 years, and he too went the way of all flesh. As you'll recall, Yosef was not given either an Egyptian or Hebrew burial. His bones were simply put in a box where they lie, still awaiting nothing, something that no human being alive at the time could even pretend to understand. Fast forward a few generations, we now know not a single human being alive by name. And as we go from Bereshit to Shemot, the dry bones of he whom his jealous brother used to call that dreamer are still prophesying to all who will listen. For many years, it seemed like no one was really listening to the prophetic message of Joseph's bones. The idea of a glorious visitation from heaven seemed like a dream and a fantasy, but it's all about to change. Welcome to the divinely appointed season of immersing ourselves in the second in the series of Sefarim that make up the Torah. This is the story of a great nation being brought forth from Abraham's loins in Egypt's womb. This is the story of a nation that was born in a day. This Sefer Torah describes in detail a prophetic season of the kingdom of heaven coming, and the will of our Father in heaven being done. This book contains the prototypical saga of divine favor and immaculate passion. It is also the ultimate chronicle of divine protection and deliverance. And it is this book, more than any other ever written, that illustrates to the world what it looks like for a divine shepherd to be with those who follow him. One does not merely read or even study a book such as this. One must bask in it. In later portions of the Torah, the Holy One will instruct us to follow in Avraham's footsteps to converge on Mount Moriah in Mass 3 times each year. He will empower and commission us to make pilgrimage to the place of ultimate surrender and resurrection at Passover, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Tabernacles. The glorious springtime crossing over journey of Passover is designed to enable us to experience afresh each year with our children and children's children the great walk to deliverance the world knows as the Exodus. The summertime pilgrimage of the Feast of Weeks is designed to empower us to relive the great Sinaitic theophany and betrothal ceremony and to annually renew the covenant that our forefathers cut on the mountain. The annual autumnal ascent of Mount Moriah for the Feast of Tabernacles is designed to awaken our hearts afresh for another wild, breathtaking season of awestruck courtship when the Holy One's presence will once again overshadow us, preserve us supernaturally, and lead us through the wilderness to the place He has prepared for us and empower us to function in the critical role He's designed for us to play in His grand plan of redemption. It's because of the events chronicled in the Book of Torah that we're about to study, that we tell our children every Passover that we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Holy One brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe, against Egypt, Pharaoh and all his household. Then He brought us out from there, that He might bring us in to give us the land which He swore to our fathers. And the Holy One enjoined us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Holy One our God, for our good always, that He might preserve us alive as it is this day. Most have come to know the second book of Torah by a Latin name. This book is Hebrew, though, and it's through and through. It's not a Catholic book about Catholicism, it's a Hebrew book about Hebrews. Its title is not Exodus, its title is Shemot. Shemot is the feminine plural form of the Hebrew noun Shem. The Hebrew noun is usually translated into English as name, but the Hebrew noun Shem involves much more than what English-speaking people think of as a name. A Hebrew's Shem is not just a convenient moniker. It is a prophetic declaration of identity and mission and worldview, purpose, and destiny of the one to whom it's ascribed. A Shem is not a proper noun by which one is called. A Shem is a description of who one is. It is said by the sages that between the lines of this Sefer Torah, the Shemot of all the Holy One's people are written. Look closely, employing the eyes of the Spirit, and you may just find your own Shem and your own life and purpose on earth described in this book. Which brings us to an important point in these studies. As the angel with whom Yaakov wrestled all night asked our beloved patriarch, so it is now the appointed time in these studies for me to ask you an important question. Ma Shemecha, what is your name? Who are you really? Who have you been in your past? And who are you now? And who are you in the process of becoming? This book of Torah is designed to help all people of the covenant rediscover the answer to all these questions. There will be three major acts in the glorious drama of divine redemption in which we're about to be called to participate. Act 1 of the saga will be set primarily in the land of exile, where the preceding Sefer Torah left off. But the Holy One will not leave us to languish in exile for enslavement for long. A mere 3 weeks into the almost 3-month-long study, therefore, we will find ourselves plunged into Act 2, adrift the shifting sands of the desert in the area between Egypt's eastern border and the fiery mountain Torah calls Sinai. The third and final act of this story will be set at the mysterious mountain of God itself. The dramatic action sequences we will encounter in the various acts of this redemptive drama will be at times so fast and furious they will be both overwhelming and numbing to the senses and mind. Act 1 will begin with bitter enslavement and persecution. And only in the first weeks of study will experience cruelty of a monarch bent on infanticide, the desperation of a Hebrew slave woman as she's driven to an unthinkable act, which is setting her 3-month-old in the waters of the mighty Nile River, the wrath of a pharaoh against a prince, the loneliness of life on the run as a fugitive from a death decree, the life-changing heat of a thorn bush engulfed in flames, yet not consumed, the bitter disappointment that results when what was trusted in for redemption actually causes oppression to become worse. As action-packed as the Parsha is, however, we will soon find out that it's only setting the stage for the most stunning series of events contained in Act 1. These action sequences merely provide the prophetic wallpaper for the 10 famous plagues through which the Holy One makes himself known to the descendants of Abraham and to Pharaoh and the people under the hypnotic spell of Egyptian culture. The ancient title Shemot was taken from the opening phrase of the Sefer Torah, which reads, "These are the names of Israel's sons who came to Egypt." Why did the ancients pick the seemingly mundane word Shemot out of this opening sentence and make it the title of critically important book of Torah? If Hebrew tradition required taking the title from the first phrase, why did they not choose the more obviously significant term, B'nai Yisrael, found in that first phrase as the title rather than the generic sounding Shemot? If the title is supposed to represent the theme of the book, some might posit that Exodus would indeed be a better title. But while it's definitely compelling in its own right, the narrative of the Exodus from Egypt is clearly not the focal point of the book. That distinction surely belongs instead to the revelation at Sinai that came after the Exodus and constituted the reason for which the events of Exodus were conceived and executed by the Holy One in the manner memorialized in the first half of the book. After all, the Holy One did not bring us out of Egypt just so we could say we were out of Egypt. He brought us out so he could betroth us to himself. The story of how the Holy One got us out from under the bondage of the Egyptians plays only an introductory role in the second book of Torah's much greater, much more glorious story of the redemptive program of the Creator. The second book of Torah is primarily about something the Latin fathers simply could not and would not embrace. What this book is primarily about is the building and the eternal destiny of the nation of Israel. That kind of nation building is only accomplished one way, with Shemot names. Names get spoken from heaven and written in a book. Spiritual identities get called forth. Eternal destinies get connected with human faces, and then the vast multitudes of Shemot get connected with each other and commissioned and empowered. This is how a chosen nation is built. As dramatic and earth-shaking as it was at the time, the sequence of events we call the Exodus really turned out to be merely an elaborate, divinely choreographed courtship ritual that preceded and laid the groundwork for the glorious Sinaitic betrothal which the Holy One had in mind for Abraham's descendants all along. This book is therefore not as much about a bunch of nameless, faceless slaves obtaining freedom as it is about the Holy One calling Israel's sons and daughters by name to come into intimate relationship with him and be launched into their destiny. Now, as we study and bask in the beauty of this book together over the next few weeks, let me suggest that you always keep a close lookout in the narrative for names. Take particular note as you read of who among the relevant characters in the drama is and who is not given a name by Torah. The revelation you receive from an evaluation like this may surprise you. The people you would think most likely to have their names remembered have been left intentionally nameless. The secret of this second Sefer Torah we're supposed to find, hidden by the Holy One in plain view, is that no matter what human beings may think is important, it is the Holy One and He alone who ultimately chooses whose name will be recorded in the Book of Life, and whose name will be blotted out. Take, for example, the mighty Pharaoh of the Exodus story. Though this Pharaoh was unquestionably the most powerful man on earth in his day, please note, Torah will not even speak once his name, not once. Indeed, this man who seemed so important and upon whose every word so many people doted in his day, is in Torah's narrative referred to only by the generic designation Melech Mitzrayim, or the King of Egypt. In this manner, the Holy One has seen to it that this vile despot who considered himself divine has been rendered completely anonymous to the world. He has borne multiple judgments of the Almighty, not the least of which is that he has had his name completely blotted out. Believe it or not, the point is, great wealth and power and influence among men do not qualify one to have their name written in the Holy One's book. Two of the midwives this man ordered to do his dirty work, however, and who risked their lives to refuse, are the first ones other than the patriarchs to have their names listed in the text. Note the irony. The names of two humble midwives who lived their life under Pharaoh's thumb are recorded forever in the book. The name of the one at whose word they could have been killed for disobedience, however, has been blotted out completely. Little Hebrew girl called Miriam, the one who had absolutely nothing material to give to anyone, but who worshipped the Creator with abandon, was ever sensitive to His voice, is given by Torah a name that shines like a star in the heavens. Millions upon millions of women have been gifted with this little girl's name. The daughter of Pharaoh is forgotten, but a slave girl with a tambourine is memorialized for eternity. The daughter of Pharaoh is another known name. We would consider her name worth knowing, and perhaps even worth memorializing. Torah, however, sees her as doing the infant she pulled from the Nile no significant favors. The doer of good deeds who found and raised in an Egyptian prince the baby of Hebrew slaves she found adrift in the basket is therefore nowhere named in the Holy One's book. Her identity remains a mystery to this day. The point is, good deeds and philanthropy apparently don't qualify one to have their name written in the book, any more than wealth, power, or influence. Also, think about the taskmaster whom Moshe saw beating a Hebrew slave. Physically, the man was imposing. He roared and shouted and cracked his whip with authority. Taking on a position of responsibility, assuming the role of a shepherd over people, does not apparently qualify one to have their name written in the Holy One's book either. The name of the man who killed this man, Moshe, and the name of Aharon, another slave this man probably terrorized at one time or another, are both now names synonymous with leadership and the shepherding of souls. The narrative begins with a listing of names of each of Yaakov's sons from which the tribes of Israel devolved. Similar listings will be found in the prophetic books of Ezekiel and Revelation. We who have just completed the study of Sefer Bereshit know that names make up these lists, and we know them well by now. The opening words of Sefer Shemot tell us, in words almost identical to a passage in the 45th chapter of Genesis, that the sons of Israel who accompanied Israel to Mitzrayim were Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. When these sons of Israel arrived in Mitzrayim, Yosef was, of course, already in Egypt. And he was busy at the time administering the economy of Egypt. And the particular region in Egypt where Yosef settled his father and brothers came to be called Goshen. There Yosef cared for the chosen family until his death. But now several hundred years have passed, and the interim hordes of Hyksos, Egyptian for rulers of foreign lands, from the east have overrun Egypt. These foreigners came in droves, beginning 45 years or so after Yosef's death. The foreigners took the best lands, including lands like Goshen, for themselves, and they enslaved the inhabitants. The Egyptians suffered at the hands of the eastern shepherd kings for almost 200 years. Then, however, the Egyptian warlord, Amosis, took Egypt back from the Hyksos by force. Amosis expelled the Hyksos and established a new, leaner and meaner Egyptian dynasty in circa 1570 BCE. This new dynasty viewed with suspicion, bordering on paranoia, all outsiders, including the descendants of Israel. So things in Egypt have changed dramatically since the end of the book of Genesis. The Egypt in which Yosef rose to power and ruled, and which welcomed, had Yaakov and family with open arms, simply it no longer exists. The Egypt that has arisen from the ashes of Hyksos wars is not a friendly place at all. Just as America, after Pearl Harbor, dealt harshly with all the people of Japanese descent, so Egypt, after the Hyksos invasion, dealt harshly and suspiciously with all who they thought might join forces with them if they ever attacked again. Welcome to Egypt, circa 1526 BCE. Meanwhile, let's look at what's going on with the descendants of Abraham. What's happened with the children of the covenant? Yaakov's long gone. Yosef's bones lie in a coffin. Ephraim and Manasseh are long dead. Conspicuous in the absence of the patriarchs are untold thousands of men and women we've not met, with hordes of children who are now scattered. To a discerning eye, these hordes can be seen to some degree or another to exhibit the same olive complexions and distinctive foreheads and noses as Yaakov and Yitzhak and Avraham. But great-grandsons and granddaughters of Yaakov they are, the chosen people of the Creator they are. But as this week's Parsha opens, these great-great-grandsons don't look much like a chosen people. They lack identity, leadership, common bond, community. They are slaves and powerless. They are statistics and a gross national product of a new, leaner, and meaner Egypt. The once famous ancestors of the hook-nosed and olive-skinned slaves are now hardly more than obscure footnotes in the history of the noble race of Mitzrayim. And they are footnotes destined to fade into oblivion. Or so it appears. The opening words of the Parsha, however, militantly declare that these great-grandsons and great-granddaughters of Yaakov are something else. These are not what they appear as mere beasts of burdens and desert rabble. They might only mean numbers and quantities and commodities to this new pharaoh and his taskmasters, but to the Holy One, they were names. Not slaves, not things, not numbers, not objects. Each one unique, each one giving lovingly by an earthly mother and father to describe characteristics imparted by a breath of heaven. They were names written in a book in heaven, each one declaring the essence of human dignity and proclaiming the covenant promises of the God of the universe. They were not obstacles to someone's plan of national or philosophical or religious development. They were not commodities to be bought and sold. They were not means to someone's selfish ends. They were names inscribed on the palm of the Holy One's hands. That is far from the end of our story. These multitudes of scattered descendants of Yaakov are not just names. It's not enough simply to recognize that the subjects of our Parsha are not what they appear to be. It's just as important to see that they also are what they do not appear to be. a people. They certainly do not appear to be a people to the human eye. They aren't unified. They're not autonomous. They're not, by and large, living together. But they're interspersed and intermixed with 100 other varieties of folk, conquered and purchased by and sold to Pharaoh over the years. Each one has, in order just to stay alive, surrendered every trace of identity in him to the fulfillment of the specific task that Pharaoh's personnel officer has assigned to him. And for that matter, each one much more of a relationship they have with whatever wretched human creature of whatever race who toils alongside him than they do to their fellow Hebrews. Thoroughly scattered grains of sand, virtually devoid of identity, blown to the four winds, unconnected to the rock from which they have been hewn. That's what they appear. Yes, that's what Abraham's descendants appear, as Shemot begins. But that is not what they are. Our Parsha sees them through different eyes. And to the Holy One, however geographically dispersed they are, however devoid of identity they appear, they are Israel. They are tribes and princes and heirs of promise. They are a people, and they are not pharaohs. They have never been pharaohs. They are the Holy Ones and His alone. They are His chosen, His Am Segulah, His Mamlecha Kohanim, His kingdom of priests. And He wants them back. And if you haven't noticed, He does not seem happy at all about what's being done to His people in Pharaoh's country. And I have a suspicion He might just be taking names. In this week's Haftarah, the prophet Yeshayahu prophesies of a day when a great shofar will be blown, and they will come who were lost and ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and those who were driven out to the land of Mitzrayim, and they will worship the Holy One on the holy mountain at Yerushalayim. And that day, Yeshayahu declares, the Lord of hosts shall become a crown of glory and a diadem of beauty to the remnant of His people. The shofar will call forth the second Exodus, and it will sound, and there will be a miraculous gathering like bone upon bone. In the passage from the Brit Hadashah that's been selected for study this week, we will complete the narrative from the book of Acts regarding the Greek surnamed Jew Stephanos. We were previously introduced to Stephanos in the week of Parsha Vayeshev. Then we learned of his name and mixed identity and divine calling and his persecution and opening phases of his trial. Now this week, we'll read how the trial turned out. We will stare with wonder at Stephanos' glorious final vision. And we'll marvel at Stephanos' beautiful last words. The Holy One willing will come to understand why Stephanos is barely going to notice the stone speeding his way. And he will not be looking quizzically or desperately or hopefully for, or even prayerfully. He will be looking steadfastly. And what he's going to see will make what is being done to him here seem a mere passing discomfort. Hence, when we hear Stephanos' cry out at last, we will not hear him cry out in pain or fear or for mercy or vengeance. He will cry out, and the words he cried out will be recorded for eternity. As life ebbed from him, he saw the One who is so loved. This week we will be called to look steadfastly into heaven like Stephanos, and we might be surprised what we see. And Stephanos means crown. Not the kind of crown I would suggest that's worn by great athletes or kings in the world. The kind of crown one lays at the feet to whom glory and honor truly belongs.